Ronnie, welcome to Forward Guidance.
Hi, Jack. Good to see you.
For those of you who don't know, Ronnie is a partner at Incrementum AG, also the author of an extremely comprehensive report on gold, In Gold We Trust report. Let's sort of start with the macro. I understand that, after the Great Financial Crisis, we were sort of, in a disinflationary era. Central banks were printing money, but it wasn't really getting into the economy. So growth was somewhat muted. I understand, Ronnie, that your thesis now is that the game has completely changed. COVID was a huge game changer, and it ushered in something that you refer to as monetary climate change. What do you mean by that?
I think it's this big move from monetary dominance to fiscal dominance. I think that in the Great Financial Crisis, the big new thing was quantitative easing. Nobody really knew what it was. Of course, the Japanese already used it and implemented it before, and I think they're now at round number 13 or 14, but they call it QQE, so quantitative and qualitative easing, which sounds even more sophisticated. But I think that central bankers they kind of understood that with simple quantitative easing, which is basically an asset swap, you cannot really create any inflation, and it doesn't have any direct impact on the economy. So I mean, after the GFC, central bankers never got tired to tell us, well, inflation is too low, we have to do more, we have to be more aggressive to get inflation numbers up. Now they are significantly above their target rates, and I mean, 1 year ago we published a special report on inflation that was called "Inflation and the Boy Who Cried Wolf." Back then, CPI in the US was at 1.2%. Now we're at almost 7%. So inflation is becoming a topic again. And now you asked what the main difference of this monetary climate change is. First of all, I think that theories like MMT, helicopter money, universal basic income, stuff like that, I think this is really becoming mainstream. And this was before the COVID crisis. I think it was primarily a topic of more left-wing economists sitting in the ivory towers, but now it is really becoming mainstream, and it's not a question of if, but a question of when it will be implemented. And I think to some degree we already see it. Then I think those this fiscal dominance can be seen, the proverbial frugal Swabian housewife. Even in Germany, nobody cares about budget deficits anymore. And I think the Maastricht criteria, for example, it will be renegotiated. So I think that big government is back. I think that's a major difference. I think that politicians really enjoy being in the driver's seat now, and trying to, to fine-tune the economic cycle and to avoid every recession. That's a big change. Then we have seen this move to credit guarantees, which is very, very important. So in the UK, for example, you had for first-time house buyers, you had the government guaranteeing you loans up to £600,000. So the risk is being shuffled from the bank over to the government, so to society at large, basically. And I think the big difference compared to 2008, 2009 is in this crisis, M2 started to skyrocket already, while during the GFC, it was only high-powered money, so central bank money going through the roof and basically trying to compensate for this credit destruction that we saw. So I think there are many, many differences, and as we're seeing now, of course, we don't believe the narrative that inflation is only transitory. I think it's going to come down the next couple of weeks and month. So this will give some leeway to central bankers, probably telling us, well, you know, the whole inflation thing is over. But I think that we will have to get accustomed to inflation rates being above the 2%. So I don't see hyperinflation right away, but I think that 3, 4, 5% inflation rates will become the new normal. And let's face it, you know, during the Great Moderation, four decades basically of falling inflation rates, most of the investors, politicians, central bankers, business owners, they don't know how to navigate in the environment of inflation. So I think this will catch many, many people on the wrong foot, and I think this is really, really crucial to understand going forward.
And Ronnie, where does gold and Bitcoin play into all of that? At Incrementum, you recently launched a gold and Bitcoin and I believe silver fund, sort of a hard assets funds to benefit in that environment. Can you walk us through your thinking why, if that environment that you just laid out, if that happens, very high levels of government budget deficits, perhaps very low interest rates as well, or, you know, inflation that is high, inflation expectations that are themselves high. Why is that sort of good for hard assets like Bitcoin, gold, silver, commodities, and, you know, gold miners as well?
The short answer is because they are not inflatable. So buying gold and buying Bitcoin is the conscious decision to sell dollars, to sell euros, and exchange it for something that cannot be inflated at will. So the inflation rate of Bitcoin and of gold is basically the same at the moment. It's 1.6%. So with every Bitcoin and every ounce of gold that you own, the natural inflation at the moment is 1.6%. And it's, you know, Jack, it's all about relative scarcity. In an environment, in a sound money environment, you actually there's no case for Bitcoin probably. There's no case for gold, but we're definitely not in a sound money environment. So of course, we're seeing the consequences of this, as Ludwig von Mises would have called it, a cracker boom, or in German we say Katastrophenhaus, which is a beautiful term. And I think, you know, the fact that real estate prices are going crazy, that you know, the art market is going crazy, that an artist can sell an invisible piece of art for $15,000, that bond markets are trading at ridiculous levels. I just had a look at Greek government debt. You know, 10 years are trading at 1%, 25 years at 1.2%. I mean, in Germany, up to 30 years at negative yields. So, I mean, those are all signs that we are not navigating in an environment of sound money. So, to come back to Bitcoin and to gold, it's a non-sovereign hedge against the monetary debasement, against an environment of deeply negative real rates. It's a hedge against ultra loose monetary policy. It's a hedge against governments monetizing ballooning government deficits. It's a hedge against financial repression. So I think most of the problems that we are facing are systemic problems, and those systemic problems cannot be solved from within the system. So you actually have to get a hedge outside of the system. And I think that gold and Bitcoin help you to go to the other side. So if you think that money is basically some sort of technology, money helps us to save time. It is an abstraction for time and energy. Then I think that compared to fiat money, that gold and Bitcoin are superior forms of money and more stable forms of money. So, you know, to answer your question, we think, and I think that not too many people within the gold camp, but also within the Bitcoin camp, we think that it's prudent to combine both. Gold for stability and Bitcoin for convexity. Of course, the track record of gold is more than 5,000 years. So trust comes from repeatedly fulfilling expectations. And I think that gold did a great job also in 2020. Gold was up 25%. It's a bit frustrating this year, to be honest. And Bitcoin, of course, I think there's many similarities. Satoshi Nakamoto, whoever it was, I think he understood the monetary system. He understood Austrian economics. He understood the stock to flow ratio that we wrote about already in our first book, Austrian School for Investors. And therefore, I think that his vision was really to create something similar to gold in the digital world. And with the next halving cycle, Bitcoin will be harder money than gold. This will continue. Do I know if Bitcoin will be around in 10 years? I've got no clue. I think so. I think so. And if it will be around in 10 years, it's probably gonna trade at a million or even higher. But there's also a fair chance that it's not gonna be around. Do I think that gold will do a pretty good job to preserve your purchasing power over the next 10 years? Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. But this also comes with the fact that then obviously the upside is significantly lower than with a new technology than Bitcoin. So, for us it makes sense to combine both. I know that this is something that many people in the gold camp don't like, but also in the Bitcoin camp. As an Austrian, I'm spending lots of time in the mountains, and I go skiing and I go snowboarding. I go snowboarding mostly off piste, and I go skiing on the on the pistes, which is a good combination from my point of view. But many skiers hate the snowboarders, and the snowboarders hate the skiers. It is what it is, but I think that both are great, and I really enjoy both. And it's a bit similar with Bitcoin and gold.
I like that. As an Austrian, you like going skiing and snowboarding, and then as an Austrian economist, you like gold and Bitcoin. I'm glad you brought up real rates. I think that gets to the heart of the matter, because real rates is sort of two things. It's nominal interest rate, what bondholders get paid in nominal terms, and then it is inflation. So I want to talk about the first inflation first. So as you said, gold had a tremendous year in 2020, particularly until April, until middle of the summer. That was a fantastic rally. But that happened as inflation itself was very low because the world was recovering from the pandemic. And now, inflation since then, inflation gold has, I think, underperformed a lot of people's hopes and expectations, even as inflation has been risen up. So, if people talk about gold as an inflation hedge, to what degree is gold just extremely early? It's sort of sniffing out inflation before the rest of the economy sees it, and then by the time inflation's there, gold's looking on until the next 2 years.
Yeah, I think that, I mean, that's, Czech, we wrote, I think, more than 3,000 pages of research over the last 15 years about gold. And I think that the direction and the momentum of long-term real rates is probably the most important driver for gold. I think that many people are a bit upset and even angry that gold didn't provide its role as an inflation hedge. But my take is that gold is sniffing out future inflation very, very early on. And as I've said, gold was up, it was up, I think, 19% in 2019. It was up 25% in 2020. Year to date, gold in dollar terms, it's down 6%. In euro terms and in many other currencies, it's up this year. So I think that people shouldn't be too greedy when it comes to gold. And 25% is actually in 1 year for an asset class like gold at 11 trillion. That's a pretty big move. So we shouldn't really expect Bitcoin-like performance from gold. Now, I think one more thing that people tend to forget. In May 2019, guess where gold was trading then?
$1,000.
1,300. So it went basically from May 2019 until August 2020, from 1,300 to new all-time highs at 2,070. So that was a pretty big move, and I think that we now really have to digest this move. Of course, it's always, in hindsight, it's always easy to come up with theories and explanations. But I think that first of all, it was the US dollar that was putting some pressure on the price of gold, especially recently. Then we should not forget that when gold made its all-time highs, US 10 years were at I think 0.4%. Now they are 1.5%, which doesn't sound like a lot, but on a relative basis, that's a big move. Then I think we are now moving into an environment where everybody believes that this is the beginning of the great rate hike cycle, and tapering, and now we're going back to monetary prudence, and everything is going to be fine. Well, this will be the shortest rate hike cycle, the shortest and the shallowest rate hike cycle ever. I mean, I'll bet a lot of money on that.
Why do you say that it's going to be the shortest rating hike cycle? Over the past 10 years, there have been a lot of instances where central banks indicate that they will raise rates to a level here and they only get to here. Why do you think in this particular instance it will be a dramatic instance of that where the Fed funds rate will not go to where the Fed implies it's going to go?
Well, first of all, because the Federal Reserve has probably the worst forecasting track record ever. Dave Rosenberg had that recently, and he analyzed everything back to 2012. It was a total of 110 data points, and he said for the Fed funds rate, the Fed forecasts had an accuracy of 37%. So that's not a lot. For core inflation, 29%. For real GDP growth, 17%. So they are usually biased to higher Fed funds rate and to stronger economic growth than we end up seeing. So they always try to sound very hawkish, but then at the end they're extremely dovish. So
Right.
this is one thing. Then, check, we have seen it. If we would be in a solid and healthy monetary system, I mean, there wouldn't be any discussion about tapering, about when is the rate hike cycle gonna start? They would just raise rates by 50 basis points. Yeah, I mean, I mean, when did they start raising rates by 25 basis points? It used to be 50 basis points, or a percent. So I think this is already telling you quite a lot, the fact that the market only seems to care when does tapering start? Will there be two or three rate hikes next year? That shows you how dependent we are on low rates and cheap liquidity. And as far as I know, that debt levels are not down significantly, both on a government level, but also for corporates on a personal level. It's fairly easy. The higher the debt level, the greater the sensitivity to rising rates. So therefore, I think in this economy that is so heavily financialized, I think there's no way that we'll go back to dramatically higher positive real rates. Perhaps nominal rates will go higher, but real rates will stay negative probably for the next couple of years. I'm pretty certain about that. And this already brings me back to gold. I mean, we crunched the numbers, and negative real rates are the foundation of every gold bull market. The 1980s and 1990s, two horrible decades for gold investors. Why? Because we primarily had positive real rates. So if you think that real rates will rise significantly, then say goodbye to gold, obviously. I don't think so.
Ronnie, a little bit of a technical question. To what degree is the gold price predicted by the level of real rates versus the rate of change in real rates? Because I know the tips yield, the real rate, has been negative for quite some while, but it's stayed negative, and over that period, gold has declined slightly. So is it really, you really need that explosive lower level where going from eight to positive eight to positive five is much better than staying at negative one?
No, I think it's important to clarify. It's really not the absolute level, but it's rather the direction. So in general, I would say that this inflation is the worst environment for gold. Rising inflation is a positive environment. Deflation, to some degree, is also a positive environment, but this inflation is the worst environment. And I think over the last couple of weeks, we saw some disinflationary moves in markets, which is interesting because Jay Powell now made the U-turn saying, well, inflation, perhaps it's not transitory, while the markets are suggesting that, at least for the next couple of months, inflation rates will probably rather fall. So we saw it with most of the commodity markets. We saw it with the gold silver ratio. We saw it with monetary growth coming in lower. We're seeing it as it seems that we're also tapering into the weakness, obviously. So I cannot rule out that we'll have a recession next year. We're seeing it with the US dollar being very, very strong, which is also a deflationary trigger. So from my point of view, my kind of roadmap is, and this is confirmed by our incremental inflation signal, I think that this inflation panic that we have seen over the last couple of weeks, this will kind of fade. So I think in spring, inflation won't be such a big topic still. And this will give central bankers probably some leeway to become more dovish again. But I think that that's also due to the base effect and so on. And I think that most of the supply disruption that we're seeing, they at some point, they in our system, with entrepreneurial creativity and the globalized market, I think those issues will be resolved at some point. So the supply disruptions, I think, will become less and less of a problem. But I think, and that's our take, this great moderation is over, and I think we will have to get accustomed to inflation rates at 3, 4, 5%, perhaps even higher. And let's face it, this is exactly what central bankers always told us. They told us we need more inflation. Deflation is the big enemy. Now they are telling us, well, now it's only transitory, it's only because of supply disruptions and so on. But if you have a look, for example, I tweeted that out to today this morning. German power base load, so the 1 year forward contract, they're skyrocketing. They were at 40 euros per megawatt hour at the beginning of the year. Now they are at 200. And I mean, for an economy like Germany, it is heavily dependent on their industry. I mean, that's a huge driver. So it will trickle down to producer prices, and it will trickle down to consumer prices. So I think, I always said, be careful what you wish for. It might come true. Now it's happening, but I think that many or most investors haven't realized that inflation will stay around. And this is also what you're seeing if you have a look at longer term inflation expectations. So the market, especially the bond market, still believes that the Fed is right, that inflation is transitory. So for the longer term, it is not being seen as a concern. But I think at some point, the market will realize, well, perhaps it's stickier than everybody thinks.
Yeah, so that could possibly the relative moderation in longer term inflation expectations, that could explain gold's relatively tough, rough patch over the past year. But also, if those inflation expectations, it's like a coiled spring. If those inflation expectations shoot higher, then yeah. The more it's held down, the more explosive it could be. Ronnie, last year in December of 2020, Fed Chair Jay Powell announced the flexible average inflation targeting regime, which simplifying basically said that we have undershot our 2% inflation target over the past 10 years. And as a result of that, we are going to try and overshoot it to make up for that. You had a chart that was so pivotal. You have a chart, which it took me about 10 minutes of looking at this chart to finally understand really what was going on here. But it's a fantastic chart. It is the inflation target of at 2%. And you see the PCE inflation rate has undershot. That's going below the blue, below the 2%. And as such, that gives the Fed leeway under the flexibly average inflation target to overshoot in the green, as you can see right here. Can you outline like this blue patch and this turquoise patch, and how that sort of how play out, and what would happen if the Fed runs out of that budget?
Well, if we take a step back and talk about this concept of flexible average inflation targeting, it means central bankers keep telling us, well, we are really sorry, but we didn't devalue your purchasing power enough over the last couple of years. We're sorry about that. But now going forward, we've got leeway to devalue it even more. So I think if you think about that concept, it's ridiculous. And what's really striking to me, and this is why we prepared this chart, the framework of this flexible inflation targeting is not very well communicated. So nobody is telling us what the time frame is and for how long inflation rates can actually overshoot. So we did like two scenarios starting in 2012, saying, well, this is our inflation budget, and if we use it up until the end of next year, so December 2022, then we can be at above 5% the whole year. And if we say, well, we will use it up our inflation credit only until the end of 2024, we can be at 3%. Now, I've got no clue how it's gonna turn out, but I think really if you think about what it actually means, it's pretty striking. And Jack, what I really missed over the last couple of days is when everybody was talking about the Federal Reserve and this big hawkish move. Their forecast for 2022 is the inflation forecast is 2.7% for next year, compared to 2.3% previously. And I already told you before that the track record is not really outstanding. So even if they get the Fed funds rate up to 1% next year, it still will result in deeply negative real rates. So everybody telling me that they are so hawkish now, sorry, that's nonsense. They're still extremely dovish. And if we now compare this current tapering environment, we shouldn't forget, first of all, the Fed is tapering now twice as fast as the last time. We shouldn't forget that asset prices are far higher at the moment. The Case-Shiller PE is at 40, which is it is 98 percentile. So only in 2% of all instances, equity valuations were higher. We know that growth is now kind of decelerating compared to previous episodes. We know that that asset markets are much more important to consumer health than previously. So it's a very much financialized economy where consumer sentiment is extremely strongly linked to equity markets and to the housing market. So if we consider that and also have a look at the current market setup, I mean, the S&P probably is a really bad gauge for the overall health of the stock market or our economy. There were some really good studies coming out from Goldman and Morgan Stanley, basically saying that only 5% were responsible for the majority of the moves in the S&P and also in the Nasdaq. So if you have a look at the broader markets, if you have a look at some sector indices, they're already telling us, well, there's no market breath anymore. So it's already telling us, well, something underneath the surface isn't going so well. So tapering into this environment is pretty dangerous. And the big question, obviously, is, it's a confidence game. How quickly can Jay Powell make the U-turn? Now that he moved from very dovish to, as the market would see it, kind of hawkish and, fighting inflation, how quickly can he make this U-turn again? Over here in the Eurozone, I mean, at least Mrs. Lagarde never even tried to make a U-turn, so that makes it a bit easier for her. But that's the big question. What will they do if the markets go down 50 or 20%? I think the most important member of the FOMC is the S&P 500, and therefore, I mean, what's left in the toolbox? What's left in the toolbox of the Federal Reserve? Not too much. So I think that, yield curve control will be implemented at some point. I think that the Federal Reserve will buy equities at some point, but I think that fiscal policy will play a much larger role going forward.
Yes, central bankers worldwide are really stuck between a rock and a hard place. One, it's inflation, and there's a lot of political pressure there. And on the other hand, if they are too hawkish and they raise hike rates too fast, they could tank the stock market and tank economic growth. There's a German word, Zugzwang.
Yeah,
of being forced to act. So that's we covered the Federal Reserve. What's going on in the Bank of England and the ECB? I understand that we're recording this on Thursday, December 16th. We both had an announcement there. What's going on with their policies, and how does that shape your outlook?
Well, for the Bank of England, they made a rate hike, I think, quite unexpected. For the ECB, everybody is expecting that they will start considering some tapering. I think it's gonna happen, but it's not gonna have a big impact because they're so way behind the curve. I mean, even in the last cycle, the Federal Reserve at least had some leeway to lower rates. We didn't have them in the Eurozone. So, it just tells me that we call it the zero rate trap. We wrote a book about that. And I think that, this is playing out perfectly, unfortunately. So the big question is, What's the way out, and probably it is going to be a combination of, first of all, fiscal financial repression, deeply negative real rates. We will probably see much more aggressive moves, as I've said before. Central banks buying equities, trying to really influence or completely take over the last rest of the last pieces of market forces and capitalism. So this is going to happen, but I think that CBDCs will also play a major role going forward. And I think, if you read what's coming out from the Bank for International Settlements and the most important central banks, CBDCs that use the momentum of cryptocurrencies, they will be implemented to fine-tune the cycle. Now the thing about a cycle is, you know, that it's going up and down. And if you avoid the recession, if you avoid the downturn, you will only make it worse for the next downturn, because, you know, a recession is something normal, something really, really healthy. As we're trying to do everything to avoid bankruptcies and banks from failing, I think that you know, the next crisis will probably be worse. If CBDCs will be implemented, I think, you know, I can imagine, and this sounds a bit crazy at the moment, but then you will have your Fed wallet. And you know, if the economy is weakening, then check, you'll get on your Fed wallet $5,000, but you will have to spend it. And if you don't spend it, it will be worthless, or the value will decrease by 10% every week, something like that. And of course, it will have an impact on the economy. But is this a prudent way to allocate capital? I would doubt it, but I think that really CBDCs are the next big thing. Unfortunately, they are the complete opposite of Bitcoin, because they're centralized. They're just something completely opposite. But yeah, I think that's gonna happen.
Ronnie, now I want to talk about Bitcoin. Let's sort of skip your base case, which a lot of people will be familiar with. Talk to me about the differences between Bitcoin and gold as an investment. We know Bitcoin's more volatile. We know it's more convex on the upside and the downside. Does it have the same drivers as gold of negative real rates, uncertainty about the future of monetary policy, that monetary policy is unsound? Or is there something that's driving Bitcoin, that's a very significant driver of Bitcoin, but that's not driving gold at all? And sort of what's your journey, having been involved with precious metals for so long, I'm coming to Bitcoin, like so many of us, as a something we've only seen in the past few years or so.
Well, through, you know, the whole libertarian scene, I found out about Bitcoin very early on, and I think in 2012 or 2013. And to be honest, back then I wouldn't have expected to become that big. Really, it is really watching history happening, and I've met so many tremendous people, bright young people, super ambitious. You know, people seeing only solutions, and not only problems. While, you know, in the banking world, it's this pessimism is quite frustrating that you're seeing in the traditional financial world. So this is really, for me, it's been a great journey. Now, I think, you know, there's many similarities between gold and Bitcoin. So it's no coincidence. For example, the stock to flow ratio, high stock to flow ratio is really crucial, for a solid money. I think it's no coincidence that you're mining Bitcoin. You know, you have to put in enormous amounts of effort to get gold out of the ground. I mean, here I've got a Solidus coin. It's more than 1,500 years old, and you know, back then, obviously, you didn't have the technology that you're having nowadays to mine, you know, 0.5 grams of gold for 1 ton of ore. I mean, you have to imagine that 0.5 grams in 1 ton of ore. How complex that is. And it's similar with Bitcoin. You know, back in the days when I started, I basically could mine Bitcoins on a normal PC. Now that's completely impossible. I think there's many similarities, and I think that over the last couple of years, Bitcoin really grew up very quickly. So it's not a kid anymore. It's not a teenager anymore, probably. It's a I don't know, a young professional or whatever. So, when we started our first fund that combines physical gold with Bitcoin in cold storage, where we're using actually the volatility. Volatility is our friend. So we are harvesting the volatility via the options market, writing options all the time. Back then, it was, the infrastructure, the futures market, options market, they were really, really, really just getting started. Now this whole market is developing. You've got the big guys coming in, which is really odd because normally they're talking about smart money and dump money, and at the end of the cycle there's always the dump money coming in, which is retail investors. But here it's kind of the opposite because it started with tech savvy retail investors, and only now the big institutions are coming in. So I think, at the moment, it seems that Bitcoin is a risk-on asset. I think it was a pretty good leading indicator on the downside for the S&P. We saw that in the end of 2017. We saw it in February 2020. We saw it in August 2020. It's also a leading indicator on the upside. We saw that as well. The crash low in March 2020, for example. So I think Bitcoin at the moment is more of an indicator for risk appetite of investors, but those correlations they can change, and we as we published a chart book on Bitcoin quite recently, and it's showing the rolling correlation between gold and Bitcoin. And actually this correlation is over the longer term, it's basically zero. But then there's episodes where they're highly correlated and then they're negatively correlated. So it's changing all the time. It's really fascinating. I have to say, I really enjoy being in both worlds. I think it's highly rewarding. I think that this is something that that I miss at the moment a bit. I don't want to sound like a old frustrated guy, but I think at the very beginning, when I found out about Bitcoin, I think that most people really understood the flaws of our monetary system. So they were questioning, what is money? Why is Bitcoin better money than gold, perhaps, or the US dollars, the US dollar? And now, over the last couple of months, it has clearly become an object of pure speculation. So, a bigger correction can happen anytime. Perhaps we've already seen the beginning, which will be normal and just healthy. But I think that in general, the fact that so many young people now really try to get out of the monetary system, and Michael Saylor, for example, he was on TV a couple of times, and he said really, from a philosophical point of view, fantastic things, and I think this is really spreading like a wildfire. So this pure speculation, of course, this is one part of the whole story. Thank God it's not the whole story. But I think that as I've said, it's a fascinating journey, and it's not only Bitcoin, it's the whole, the whole DeFi space. I think in the NFTs are fascinating. I to be honest, I don't understand all the stuff that is coming out all the time. It's just so hard to follow it. But everybody telling me, well, this is just a bubble. I'll keep telling them, well, then you say that technology is a bubble and that the digital world is a bubble. If you think that we will go back to the old world, fair enough. Then we probably won't need any cryptos. We won't need Bitcoin. But I don't think that we're gonna go back. And then I think that the COVID crisis was definitely also a catalyst for that. We all got accustomed to doing meetings on Zoom. My dad, who is like 75 years old, I mean, he's totally fine with MS Teams, with Zoom calls and so on. And I think being against cryptos would also mean you're against the digital world and you're betting against that. And I just don't see that happening.
Yeah, what was the, by the way, Ronnie, you and me both, that makes two of us for not understanding NFTs, but the George Soros quote about like the first thing when I hear a bubble I do is buy. Ronnie, my final question for you, I know you got to go, very generous with your time, is because you took up the gold coin from Rome and the solidus, I got to take up the Latin and ask you, quo vadis? In other words, where do you think it's going? So that's gold and Bitcoin. Look, no one has a crystal ball, obviously, but you and your colleague, Mark Valik, have put together a few little probabilistic ranges for outlook for gold. I think it's in 2030, very long-term view. And then Bitcoin, I think that outlook may be a little bit shorter.
Yeah, well, for gold, we've got a very simple valuation model. I worked in a bank for a couple of years, and I know that there's very, very complex models. The problem with those models is the more complex they are and the more sophisticated they sound, the less they work. So our monetary model is based on trust in the monetary system and the backing of the M2 monetary aggregate for the United States. So you can read what's in this model in our 2020 report, and we come up with a price target at $4,800 by the end of this decade, which sounds like a lot, but I mean, 1970s, highly inflationary decade. Gold was trading at $30 in 71, and then it went up to 850. Who would have believed that? And we saw the big mid-cycle correction from $200 down to $100, and then from 100 up to 800 within 4 years. So this can happen. And now I think gold is really some sort of an anti-bubble.
If you multiplied that 25, 30x gains, that would be something like $40,000 or $50,000 an ounce for gold. Obviously, 1970s was a lot more volatile. And then what were you saying about Bitcoin?
Yeah, well, for Bitcoin, I think it's pretty much binary, and I think it's, we know the Lindy effect. We know what's going on, how flexible it actually is, how strong it is, how big the community and the user base nowadays is. So I sometimes make the comparison with WhatsApp. I mean, there was a time when, I don't know, I think there was mostly in the European Union where everybody was really scared, they're changing their privacy rules and stuff. And then at some point, so many people said, well, I'm leaving WhatsApp. I'm just leaving WhatsApp. I'm going to Signal or to Telegram. And then many people realized, well, the network doesn't have any value if there's like only 10 or 15% of your contacts on Signal or Telegram. So they came back to WhatsApp. So I think, and this is what Jeff Booth brilliantly described. So I think it really the next system or the next Bitcoin would have to be probably 10 times more, 10 times better and more valuable to the users. And I just don't see a competitor at the moment. Of course, it can change, definitely. So if that scenario is right, I mean, if gold goes to $4,800, that will probably go hand in hand with inflation. That will go hand in hand with deeply negative real rates. And I don't see Bitcoin not doing very well in that environment. It's hard to put on a price tag, but I think, in 10 years from now, why shouldn't we be trading at a million or something? Something like that. I mean, that sounds like a ridiculous number at the moment, but imagine what happened to real estate prices. Imagine what's happened to in the art market. It can happen, and actually, with just the stuff that is going on this year with El Salvador, for example. I mean, that's one of the most fascinating monetary experiments of the last couple of decades. I think there's so much going on. I think that at some point, sovereign wealth funds or even central banks will start buying Bitcoin. So, yeah, it's going to be a fun ride, but it's going to be a volatile ride.
Yeah, Ronnie, I know you're extremely time pressed. So for this final question, just answer one, the other, or I don't want to answer that. I recently had a guest earlier in this month, Kevin Muir, describe to me why he was going long on gold, but short on Bitcoin. On a volatility adjusted basis, which side of that trade, long gold, short Bitcoin, or long Bitcoin, short gold, and sort of which do you think will outperform over, let's say, the next year? So just say gold, Bitcoin, or I don't want to answer.
Tough one. I don't want to answer. Actually, you know, I think the way I'm heavily invested in our funds. We've got skin in the game. And we're just doing both, and we're rebalancing between gold and Bitcoin. We're using the options market to gauge the volatility. And you know, I've been an analyst for too long. and it's tough, but I think from a money manager perspective, I think that's the prudent way. And you know, it's relative to, you know, as I've said previously, I think it's just this competition that we're seeing, you know, with who was it, Michael Saylor against who was the representative of the gold camp?
Frank Giustra.
Frank Giustra.
Yeah.
Come on, I mean, do team Bitcoin and gold against the central bank. I mean, that should be the competition, but not Bitcoin against gold. I think they're friends, they're cousins, brothers, whatever. So yeah, that's my take on that. Kevin Muir, I have to say, his newsletter is fantastic. I love it. It's great value. So I'm a big fan of Kevin.
Yeah, me too. I liked his quote in your newsletter. Ronnie, thank you for being so generous with your time. Great to hear your insights. Thank you for sharing your knowledge. People can follow you on Twitter at Ron Strifela, and also obviously check out Incrementum AG. You got the new precious metals and Bitcoin fund. Also, Ronnie, you and I today, we spoke about a lot of macro high-level themes. We didn't as much get into the chart, so I really urge the audience, we're going to put a link in the description to the chart book. So definitely check out those charts. Really a lot of things that can be learned from them. Ronnie, thank you so much, and love to have you on again sometime soon.
Thank you very much, Jack. Thanks for inviting me. Happy holidays. Have a good new year, and I'll see you soon. Thank you very much.